Welcome to Dead Pilot Society, the show that takes comedy pilots from A-list writers that were sold and developed at networks but never produced, and gives them the table reads they never got a chance to have. I'm Andrew Reich, the creator and co-host of Dead Pilot Society. Okay, this is our first separate after-show episode. We give Dead Pilots table reads, and we also bring you interviews with the creators. So hopefully you've already listened to the Spacebound table read, or maybe you don't mind spoilers and you want to listen to the interview first and then listen to the table read with all of the information you've gotten from the interview. That's cool too. Either way, I am just happy that you're here to listen to my interview with the brilliant and charming Emerald Fennell. Emerald was the showrunner of season 2 of Killing Eve. She's as an actress, she played Nurse Patsy Mount on Call the Midwife and Camilla Parker Bowles on The Crown. And she is also the writer and director of Promising Young Woman, which has been nominated for 4 Golden Globes, Best Screenplay, Best Director, Best Motion Picture Drama. She also picked up a nomination for a Writers Guild Award for Best Screenplay. So many great insights into the writing process to be had here. I love how she talks about how her scripts often begin with just a vivid scene that pops into her head. This is a great one. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Emerald Fennell.
Hey there, beautiful people. Did you hear that good, good news?
Something about the baby Jesus?
He's coming back.
Or do you mean the fact that Apple Podcasts has named Fanti one of the best shows of 2020?
I mean, we already knew that we was hot stuff, but a little external validation never hurts, okay?
Hosted by me, writer and journalist Jared Hill.
And me, the ebony enchantress myself, Javel Anderson.
Fanti is your home for complex conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the people, places, and things we're huge fans of, but got some anti-feelings toward.
You name it, we Fanti. Nobody's off limits.
Check us out every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your Slayworthy audio.
I mean, we're here the day after you just were nominated for Best Motion Picture Drama, Best Director, Best Screenplay. Carey Mulligan got a Best Actress nomination. I mean, that is so incredible.
Thank you.
And maybe it's a relief that even though I'd be happy to just talk about Promising Young Woman the whole time, maybe it's a relief not to talk about Promising Young Woman and to talk about Spacebound.
It's really nice to talk about Spacebound.
It's so funny. I just had my morning coffee because it's morning here. And now every morning I think nice brown coffee. So thanks for that. In some of the interviews I've read about the film, I know you talk about that there was a scene that sort of just came to you, that, you know, an opening scene of your lead just sort of suddenly being sober and saying, what are you doing? Was there anything like that with Spacebound? What was the germ of Spacebound? Do you remember?
I think the germ of Spacebound was the same thing. I think it was the coffee shop scene. It was kind of the opening scene with a kind of these kind of three weird people in a coffee shop. And I suppose somebody must have cut in line, or I don't know, maybe a guy was being a douchebag in a coffee shop. And I probably thought like, ugh, I wish I could put my hand on him and just explode him. It's usually something. It usually comes from a bit of like idle violence. So I think the first thing probably was G456 in the coffee shop exploding that guy. But I think more generally, I wanted to. I love a fish out of water comedy. And so I was sort of, you know, thinking about all those great like movies that I watched when I was little, like Splash and Enchanted and all of those sorts of things, which have these kind of incredibly guileless female characters who, you know, find themselves in this kind of extraordinary modern world. And it just felt like such a fun opportunity to talk about the stuff that I love talking about, really, which is why we are the way we are. And I think having an alien who's actually quite savvy, in spite of her kind of childlike wonder, she's actually not an idiot. for people to have to explain why rules are different for different people and all that kind of stuff just seemed like an incredibly fun premise and a really fun opportunity for an old fashioned like apartment share comedy too, I think.
Right. It's funny, you know, Splash is something certainly that I thought of, you know, when I read it, and that you have this fish out of water who happens to be a beautiful woman. And so what that does to that fish out of water story and how people react to her. And it's funny, again, in light of the film, you know, I think about how Dan behaves with her and how he, you know, your guys in this are certainly a bit more gentlemanly, even Phil, as awful as he is, you know, tells Dan like that woman is crazy. You know, he's the voice of come on now.
Oh, definitely. I think they're like, it's interesting. I think certainly when it comes to sort of sitcoms and the sitcoms that I really love that are kind of ensemble pieces, like obviously Friends, but Parks and Rec and The American Office and, you know, 30 Rock and the shows that I watch again and again and again and again, everyone's nice, or at least everyone is redeeming. You know, you don't really want to watch a comedy about a bunch of people that you really hate. I mean, because even Arrested Development, which I would say every single person in that show is an abomination, you love all of them deeply. In fact, the more awful they are, the more you love them. So it's kind of, maybe that's the exception that proves the rule. But for me, yeah, but creating a world and part of Spacebound was trying to just make everyone lovable. And also, you know, I suppose the kind of wider premise of it is that a bunch of people who have no idea how to be humans successfully. Venetia, who's just like a space cadet baby doll, sort of millionaire's daughter, and Phil, who's just kind of in complete denial about the kind of person he is, and Dan, who's just incapable of making any decisions or, you know, just kind of terrified of life. So it sort of seemed like a really nice thing for somebody to have to be taught by teachers who had no idea what they were doing.
Right. Yeah. Just her, Venetia being the female role model seems deeply problematic.
Well, originally I wrote Venetia because I wanted to do it. But then Lolly did the reading, and then you know, thinking about your reading, and I just think Lolly is the funniest. I think she's probably one of the funniest actresses in the world. And so I thought, it's just, you know, I think she'd be amazing. And now I've seen that, I'm just like, that, yeah, no one ever must do it except for her. She's so funny. And it's so fun. You know, what's so exciting about your podcast is that, you know, all of these pilots that we write and that just get, you know, chewed up by the system fairly, you know, that's the way it goes. You never get to hear them unless you're lucky enough to have gotten to that stage, but, you know, certainly our script didn't get to that stage. So I'd never heard it. So it's just such a joy.
That's the whole point of what we do. And it's why we take, you know, scripts that weren't shot, because if they were shot as disappointing, I mean, and in some cases, it's almost more painful when you make it and then it doesn't go. But on the other hand, you got to cast it. You got to pick the actors. You got to hear it read. You got to see it shot. And, you know, so the point of this is exactly what you're saying. It's just like you slave away for so long on these things, and then you just never get to hear it read aloud, except sort of in your own head. And, you know, and in the case of yours, just to hear that cast that you really helped us put together was just extraordinary. So speaking of, you know, so tell me a bit about the origin of it and how you pitched it and what its journey was through the process.
Well, I don't really pitch things. I just write the script.
Okay.
So I'm not very good at pitching, because I didn't, well, for, I mean, a million reasons, but also I think it's kind of the moment it's done, I'm already out of there. In a weird way, like the moment it's down on paper, I'm out of there, like in my brain. Not that I don't love doing notes and revisions and stuff, but like if I find the kind of slightly backwards way that we are expected to do it, which is to discuss it until you're sick of it and then to write it down, just kind of kills it for me personally and creatively. So I just write stuff, and I've, you know, written millions of things that are just diabolically bad, and they don't ever go anywhere. People just say like, no, but this was one of the ones that I think, you know, people liked. And I was lucky, but I think it's, you know, certainly for me, I don't know how you do it, whether you like to pitch or you kind of go in with a script. I guess you don't really have to anymore, but.
No, that's not true. I mean, I've done it both ways, and I completely agree with everything you're saying. You're absolutely right. And yet I end up pitching more than writing things, just because I know too much of just about how it works and how the odds are more in your favor with a pitch, because people like dealing with it that way. They like being able to put their imprint on it. They like being able to shape it. But you're so right that pitching, you know, there's so many things you don't know that you're faking your way through and making promises that you may not be able to keep, and having to think about, yeah, it is very backwards. So I can see maybe why this feels so fresh, and is because it didn't go through that ringer. You did just write it.
Well, I think also there are things that certainly, like, this is kind of one of the really early drafts, I think, that we read before it went to Fox, and before this was the version pretty much that went out to producers rather than channels and networks. So it is kind of an early version. And it's not to say I don't think notes and brilliant producers are incredibly valuable, because they are. But I think what you are saying is so right, is that when you pitch something, it could be the best thing in the world. It could be the biggest masterpiece of all time, and everyone can invest in it. And so whenever I just find then you deliver something, and even if it's sensational, it's not exactly the thing that was in someone's head. And so you're up against, it's a bit like being, you know, it's a bit like trying to make someone fall in love with you who is in love with, I don't know, like Marlon Brando or something. It's just kind of, you're hiding to nothing. I think the thing that I love about having a spec that sort of doesn't have much information around it is it's sort of only judged on its own merits, rather than this kind of nebulous imaginary thing that could have been wonderful if they'd done that thing that you wanted them to do with their beautiful cousin who really needs a leg up in the industry, or, you know, whatever detail it is that people want. But you know, this isn't, I've not really, I think this is the only comedy, yeah, this is the only pilot script that I have ever sold.
And how did, so at the point that you wrote this, where were you in your writing career? I mean, let's back up, because which came first, the acting or the writing?
So the acting came first, but I was also writing books. So I guess acting was first by maybe like a couple of years. But then in England, I was in a kind of long running show called The Midwife, which was sort of 6 months on, 6 months hiatus. And so in the hiatus, I did that show for 3 years. And in every hiatus, I wrote a book. So the first two were kind of Harry Potter age sort of children's books, and middle grade, I guess you would call them. And the last one was like an adult thriller. So I started doing that. And then Jessica Knappett, who is this, unbelievably genius writer and showrunner, who did her own show called Drifters in the UK. And she's the person who gave both me and Phoebe Waller-Bridge our first writing credits. And she's just the greatest teacher and a brilliant genius. So she was writing the fourth series of her show Drifters, and she'd read Monsters, my most recent book, and asked if I'd like to come in and, you know, and write on some of it. And so that was kind of what really started. But at the same time, I'd been, you know, in England I'd pitched a lot of drama shows, and kind of they'd kind of gotten, it's a very different system in England. So they kind of, yeah, you don't do it in the same way you do it in America. So yeah, but Spaceman was the first thing I sold, I think. Yeah, it was America. Yeah.
And okay, so at the point there, you were hired on Drifters. Mm. Had she read dramatic works, or had she just read the novels? Did you have scripts that she read?
I had a few scripts, I suppose, that I'd written for things, that dramas and movies, and so maybe I'd given her that. But I think she really loved Monsters, and originally she just wanted somebody to, you know, chat with, and because again, in England it's such a different system. You don't have a room. You have a creator, and you have much more contained things. And Jess is the creator and star of her show, and she writes all the episodes. And you know, you might get somebody in to come in and help on an episode, but it's not remotely the same as a room. So I think it's much less of a, you know, her getting me in for maybe an episode to see if it worked is maybe less of a risk, and it was more. And we got on incredibly well and had the same sense of humor. And I was a huge fan of the series, and and so, yeah, so it was kind of, it was lucky, you know.
Wasn't handing you off a first draft to write of the show. She was pretty much writing the drafts.
I then wrote two episodes.
Okay, you did. Okay.
Of the six. And so, yeah, so in the end, but again, it's a more organic process, but normally what you would do, is give people an outline and then. But it's an outline that, you know, the creator writes entirely themselves.
Okay.
Like Jess or whoever else it is.
Yeah. I guess I'm just asking you, the form so different from writing novels, you know, did you learn that on the job, or you had already kind of been writing?
Yeah, I'd sold a couple of ideas to people. I'd written a couple of film script. So I did have specs. I did have stuff to show her. I just don't know that she asked to see it, because okay. That's the thing about someone like Jess, who's so brilliant, and why it's so, I'm so grateful. And it's so important I think the system in England is for its flaws really brilliant, because it does mean that people are kind of autonomous. And so they can kind of say, I'm going to give this person a chance and see how it goes. And if it doesn't work out, I can fix it or whatever it is. And she's just incredibly gifted. And she's intuitive. But she also taught me really quickly, you know, so she, all of the stuff that she knew and had learned herself, she just taught me super fast.
What a gift. Yeah. So how did Spacebound make its way to America and to Gail Berman? And do you remember how that happened once you had written that spec?
So I wrote the spec and it got sent out to various people, and I met with, and so then I came to LA for a week or whatever it was. And I met with a few, cause I had a manager at that stage. Maybe even an agent, I think just a manager at that stage. And so, and a few people liked it. But Jackal Group, which was Gail Berman's company, I just really got on with all of them. And they were really kind of funny. And I think so much of it is just, do you like them? Do you like people? You know, are you all going to, do you laugh at the same jokes? I think it's kind of interesting. I don't know what, you know, how you feel about this, but when the number of times you go in and pitch something and it's just dead, like funeral parlor, and it's just, and then they're like, oh, we loved it. And you just think, but what? Because
you showed no signs.
You just seemed so miserable to see me. And I think that's it. So, and I just loved Gail Berman. She's just so smart and funny and cool. And also she's, the thing that I love more than anything working with someone is she's just incredibly straightforward. Gail loved it and she was amazing and I loved her and I loved everyone who worked for her. And then I think they, because understandably I was, you know, I hadn't at that stage, I don't think, or maybe I'd written an episode of Drifters, but you know, I was certainly by no means like showrunner material, and especially not in America where I had no experience. And so they introduced me to a few very like experienced and funny and brilliant showrunners. And so again, you know, you talk to all of those guys and you sort of try to, especially like over Skype or whatever, like in the pre-Zoom days, it's kind of difficult to get an idea. But then I was introduced to Craig and Bradley, who were just immediately the funniest people I'd ever met. They were just really, great. I just loved them. I loved all of their ideas. They were the perfect combination of, like, you know, respectful because it's somebody else's idea and they understood that that's something that's very, like, personal, but at the same time, like, incredibly wise, so clever about how things, you know, are supposed to be. I didn't know any of the rules and they kind of taught me all of that stuff again. So I was just really lucky to have worked very quickly with lots of people who were very good at teaching in a way that didn't feel like I didn't feel like a student. They were all clever and kind enough to make me feel like a grown up, even though I really wasn't. And I'm definitely, I don't think I'm a natural pupil because I'm really annoying and a know-it-all. And I think it's like Tracy Flick in Election. So yeah, to find those people that could bear me was really nice. Craig and Bradley were amazing.
And help you navigate through what's a crazy system once you've sold the script. So at this point, were they brought in once you had sold it to Fox or before?
That's a good question. Yeah. I actually don't remember. I think we sold it to Fox and then, it's like good to ask Gail. I don't know. Also, the problem for me is that it's all slightly amplified by the fact that I was in London.
Right.
You know, so I'll come out for like a week maybe to pitch and things, but actually in terms of the kind of linearity of it, I'm a bit stupid because it's hard to remember exactly because I was here.
And I don't mean to keep asking questions that you may not remember, but I'm wondering if there were sort of comps for shows when you were talking to the network about how you imagine the show going forward, whether there were other shows you were referencing.
I think that the stuff that we were talking about was more movies. I think it was more Enchanted and Splash, but we're talking about, like, you know, certainly the sort of feeling, the kind of friendship and the sort of slight, like, heightened humor, maybe, of something like New Girl. We talked a bit about, you know, stuff like Mork and Mindy, Dharma and Greg, even, like those kind of, I think those odd couple relationships are so appealing too. And Dan and G456 felt like that kind of, those two sort of characters. But again, you know, we'd sort of given them the script. So they kind of, they were quite, I think it was sort of quite clear sort of what it was going to be, I think, from the get-go. The one thing that was harder to explain to people was the Overlord and the kind of beta complex world.
Right.
Because initially, and in the first draft that we read for your podcast, it was going to be like It's a Wonderful Life. And it was just going to be, you would going to hear voiceovers over the kind of twinkling stars. And then very quickly we were like, it's just absolutely, it's going to get so boring after a while. And so then, you know, then it was kind of like, well, how do we get a really camp, quite kind of old fashioned, almost like 70s feeling sci-fi space world? Like, I think it just needed a lot of crystals and oozing. And, you know, but it's difficult with that stuff because, of course, the less you know, you know, we were kind of very reluctant to ever leave the Overlord's palace because the more you know about Beta Complex, it's so funny because everything that G456 says about it, like over the course of like all of our later notes and all that kind of stuff and different drafts, it's just so horrifying. It's like the most violent, senseless, cruel planet in the world. And yet it's still better and more highly thought of than Earth. It was important to us that we would like to see Beta Complex. It's a bit like Maris. Is it Maris? You can't see the full horror. It's better that we never know about the movies. We can't see the trees that are made of meat.
But so you were, because, you know, it's a little ambiguous at the end of this pilot that we read. It seems like, okay, they're leaving her on Earth and going off. It's not totally clear how the Overlord and the Round Man and the Tall Man are going to stay present in the series, even though you're dying for them to, because the Overlord is such a great character.
So basically the premise was that B456 and her shenanigans would become the Overlord's sort of pet obsession. And so they have viewing orbs. And it's sort of basically they watch, that the idea was that everyone in Beta Complex watches Earth, but a bit like the way that we watch, you know, really like horrifying reality TV shows. And the Overlord becomes obsessed with G456 and Dan and their romance and is basically kind of watching it. And because he's less bloodthirsty when he's happy, the Tall Man and the Round Man have to kind of keep slightly chivying things along down on Earth to make things a little bit more exciting, kind of throwing in little, little spanners in the works to,
like Hunger Games style, kind of.
Exactly, to make it, to keep the Overlord interested in it. And then she kind of becomes a huge star in Beta Complex, a bit like, I suppose, the Truman Show or something. So, I mean, you know, and that is all very sort of vague. These were just like, you know, our possible future things. But we definitely wanted the despotic Overlord to have a real soft spot for G456 and Dan.
So they're sort of a Greek chorus, but not completely just observers. They are affecting things in their G4.
They're affecting things, but also they have their own stuff going on. Okay. You know, the Tall Man is in love with the Overlord. And so that romance plays out over the course of it, the unrequited romance. So it was kind of... absolutely, Beta Complex would be kind of place in and of itself that we didn't spend that much time in, but that was always a kind of fun, you know, it would always have its own sort of little mini storyline every episode.
But the A story, the sort of main thrust, you imagine, was this romance between...
Well, I think yes, the romance, but much more, it was going to be a flat share comedy, which is what in England, I don't know what it would be called in America. Is it called the same thing?
No, it's definitely not called a flat share.
What is that?
A hangout show.
I think that is probably the best description of what it is, because truly it's a very high concept hangout show. I think it was kind of going to be important, I think, as we went along, that G456's alienness somewhat recedes. You know, that yes, but she has to function. She has to get a job. She has to get good at that job. She has to, like, you know, she's going, there comes a point where getting back to Beta Complex is less and less appealing to her because she's more and more invested in her life on Earth. So I think that was the kind of main tension was always going to be when they want her back to kind of as a queen of Beta Complex. And she needs to kind of choose whether she stays or goes.
Right. And her powers have left her while she's on.
Oh, yeah. She never has powers again, I don't think. Or certainly, like, maybe there'd be an episode where they gave her powers back for a joke. But, like, it was important that she was, to all intents and purposes, human by the end of the episode. And then she was just, she was just left. She was stranded in a human body. And there was nothing she could do about it.
And... you know, there's that line where she talks about what women, this is what women on Earth wear.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be such a hint of what the show seemed to be about. You know, this sort of feminist, more feminist than Splash in a way, because of the time of that it really is about. How would you think women are meant to behave if you have just observed, you know, film and television and these images that were, I always imagined going forward, a scene where she's just been watching Pornhub on Phil's computer, and she's learned all kinds of lessons about this is how human women behave.
Well, also, but beta complex are very, very familiar with human sex because the humans are famed for their violence and their hideous and horrifying genitalia. So, like, I think there's sort of, it's funny, the things that do not shock her are interesting. And, like, again, that's stuff that happens later, but, like, she's not at all, she's not a baby or a prude. She actually finds, like, any sort of deep horror, violence or sex quite normal. But other things completely baffling. So one of the things was, like, we were talking about, like, you know, Dan has an interview for a job and she says, oh, here's your lipstick, you gotta look your best. And Dan's like, oh, men don't wear lipstick. You know, it's just like, obviously I'm not selling this. This is not like, this is gonna, definitely not gonna get picked up by anyone else on the back of this terrible pitch. But like, it's just those little things. It's the little kind of weirdnesses of all of our lives that, you know, kind of are hangovers from God knows what. Or the thing that I used to say when I was pitching it was like, you know, and we were talking about this exact thing, like, how is it going to be going forward? What's the kind of message? And I would sort of say, like, and actually I can ask you, maybe it will work. When you, it's difficult to ask people in America because there isn't parallel parking, but how often does somebody, a stranger, stop and guide you into a parking space or like give you, guide you as you're driving?
That happens. We have parallel parking, you know.
That happens. Do people ever stop and like?
Yeah. I mean, it's happened to me, not frequently, but certainly that happens.
Okay. So that's quite unusual because for most people, when I discuss this, for women, it happens to them like every third time that they're parking or doing any kind of maneuver. A kind of helpful man will like
supervise.
But generally speaking, all of the guys I know or were speaking to were like, that has never happened to me. So maybe I'm afraid you might be a terrible driver. So this might not work.
Yeah, usually, I don't know. Usually a whole group of people will gather around to help. Like, I don't know. But
yeah, they're just like, and there's a child lying in the street. And it's, yeah. So yeah. No, I think it's just those little kind of, it's the stuff that is, well, and there's so much, you know, based on your attractiveness, based on your weight, based on your skin color, based on your clothes. There's so much to explain about the way we treat each other, and the kind of invisible hierarchies, or increasingly, I think, visible hierarchies that are kind of emerging. So it just seemed like a kind of great, my favorite sort of thing is anything that's like, you know, anything that has a bit of social commentary, but isn't a crushing bore.
Right. And was Fox, during the development process, were there things they were trying to steer you away from, towards? Did they seem nervous about the high concept nature of it? Or I know that's obviously very baked in, so if they bought it, they knew they were getting themselves into a space alien comedy. But did they, do you remember what direction?
I think that they wanted more. I think they wanted it to just be more kind of, or the pilot at least, to have more characters, to have more places. So we introduced kind of workplace, you know, G456 actually accidentally gets a job at Dan's workplace. But I think like a lot of times, then what happens is you just have so much, there was so much then going, it's probably mostly my fault, but then there was then so much going on that it was kind of hard to focus. There were lots of different, and then, you know, there's that thing I think that people always have of like introducing peril and right, having the unexploded bombs and all of that kind of stuff that people ask and talk about. But actually for me with comedy, and maybe this is because I'm just super basic, I don't really want any peril. I don't really need an unexploded bomb or an antagonist in a funny way. I'm really happy for everyone. I'm happy for the highest stakes of an episode to be like is the cake going to cool in time for it to be iced or whatever it is? Like, I think that in a way, and actually I was really proud of the episode that we all did together. And I think it was really great. But there was just, I think all of us felt by the end that so much was going on that we kind of weren't entirely sure. It could have been like an hour and a half long pilot. Right.
Yeah, even, you know, in this, I wonder, you know, there's the detective, and that's the note that you end the pilot on, is, you know, the detective sort of getting a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, to me, I get that it gives you a sort of cliffhangery ending. And yet when I think about, well, what do I want to watch in this series going forward? It's not really the
detective. Fairbanks. He was a goner, I think, quite early on. I think I realized that, and we were like, we kind of nixed him. But yeah, no, but even it's so amazing, like hearing it already, I was like, just itching to be like, oh no, I need to change. Oh, I want to sort of tamper with it, because, you know, I think certainly the second half kind of slightly meanders a bit, and there's, you know, there are things that you would, of course, inevitably change once you've heard it. But I generally like things quite straightforward. The things that I like are just,
Well, I think if the characters, I mean, each character is just really clear and well drawn. And so I think, you know, for me, just as a viewer, when you're watching it, it's just like, oh, I want to see Dan and Phil and Venetia hanging out with this new weird roommate. And you're right, those hangout shows, and I do love the Overlord as just a flavor that you don't want to disappear, but your stories you're going to be telling seem like, oh, they're in that apartment. These are just friendship stories. But with this big hook, which is one of those things where in the TV business, it's so tricky. These, you know, high concept shows, people often, you know, they'll buy them and then they get scared of them when it comes down to picking things up. And they'd much rather something that's much more, oh, someone has to move back in with their parents, or the parents have to move back in with their kids, or something so low concept is what I'll get through with the networks, at least.
That's interesting. I think possibly that was it. I feel like it almost got more high concept though as we were going. I think I'd be really interested. I haven't read, you know, it's the first time I'd read it for years when we did the read, you know, or when you like contacted me about it. And I haven't read the like last draft we did, but it was still quite high concept. At the end, in fact, even more so. I think there was like a conspiracy theorist who was, you know, trying to, who kind of knew, had been tracking her, and there was a whole thing.
It is funny too. I mean, I know it's a few years ago, and you have memory issues, but it, no matter what, even if you don't, there's a sort of almost fugue state you get into in these rewrites, because they're coming so fast and furious at the end of the development process. And often you're just like, I don't even know. Wait, that you'll read one of these scripts and it's just like, I put that in? Like, I don't even remember that and why I did it. But as you're getting closer, you're so desperate to please these people. And it's like all sorts of things can end up in a script in that final draft.
You're absolutely right. And it is, it's just like you get into that. Yeah, it's complete fugue, and you've rewritten. And also there were a lot of us, because there was, you know, brilliant Jackal and Craig and Bradley, and we were all like, you know, we were all kind of working on it all the time to kind of get it straight. And so, there were just so many drafts flying around. But I think also it's a funny thing that your mind does. It's a kind of, you're incredibly focused on it. And then when you find out it's just a goner, you sort of emotionally, it's a bit like breaking up with someone and you can just cannot remember why you were together. it's not that I don't absolutely love the script or like love everyone I worked with, but it's more like you shut it out of your mind, because it's like, it's a dead end, it's finished, it's a sad thing that you love, but it's, and so yeah. And I think also for me, you know, amnesia aside and all of that kind of stuff, between that moment and now, I just worked so kind of constantly that I think I've sort of slightly
Yeah.
To my synapses.
So how does Killing Eve, so you and Phoebe had worked together on Drifters. Is that, that's where you met each other?
No, so we didn't work together on Drifters. She worked on a different series to me. It was just that it just so happened that Jess had, had hired both of us separately. No, I met Phoebe. We were both actors in a film called Albert Nobbs. And we were like, it was, early jobs. And so we met there and, always got on. And then I had sold a show to Sid Gentle a few years beforehand with a friend of mine called Daisy Lewis. We'd sold a sort of period drama to them. So they'd optioned, actually Sid Gentle had also optioned my first two books, The Shipperton Hall and The Creeper. So I knew.
Listeners know Sid Gentle is.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So Sid Gentle, the producers of Killing Eve.
Okay.
So it was kind of that. So I knew Phoebe very well, and just love her and think she's the biggest genius in the world. And I had worked already with Sid Gentle, and so when Phoebe was, because she was always going to go and do Fleabag 2 after she did Killing Eve 1. And so they needed to get a room together, which is, again, a very unusual thing for England. And initially I, like everyone else there, was there to just be in a room. It was kind of an experimental room. And then we were all kind of, it was decided that we were going to write each have an episode, and then as it went on it became clear that it's not an egalitarian process. Unfortunately, it's impossible to do it like that, no matter how amazing everyone is. And so I to my great surprise and delight, promoted to that position. So it was kind of, quite luckily for me, I was suddenly just handed this thing that, I had. It was a much slower process. So when I kind of signed on to do it, I was just signing on to be in a room for a week, just for everyone to kind of talk with Phoebe and to kind of put some ideas together and think about, and the show hadn't come out. So it wasn't a huge thing that it became. And then, bit by bit until, once we were much closer to shooting and the producers wanted somebody to, be in charge of it, then, and by then you're working so hard anyway, you're writing every second, that I didn't have the time then to be anxious about it, luckily, even though it was extraordinarily anxiety inducing. So it was, it was a sort of combination of factors, really, I think. But I'd been, working, I think, a lot for a while, trying, like everyone, trying to get stuff off the ground. Nearly having stuff, having books optioned, nearly going, having TV series nearly going, having, So I think then I was just incredibly lucky that Killing Eve, have the system that they have, which is just giving people opportunities. And, it was amazing. It's unbelievably grueling because it's just so, the volume of stuff, yeah, just beyond, but it was also incredible. I mean, it was insane. It was wonderful.
Yeah. And not an easy show to shoot and so many locations and such.
Yeah, but again, it's a slightly different thing because it's a slightly different system. You're not in America because you have a room and an ongoing room. Your showrunner can be as much a writer as a producer. But in England, when you have a much smaller remote room, we didn't have an ongoing room. We had some amazing writers and people, we all worked together a bit before shooting, but during shooting, there's no room or anything.
Okay.
So you are writing constantly, and so are the other writers, amazing writers too, but not together. So it's not, the one thing is, even though you're producing it in the sense that you're on casting and you're watching all the rushes and you're doing all of that stuff, you're not on set every day doing that stuff, which, so it's a slightly, yeah, it's a slightly different thing. Because you go, I mean, you just couldn't physically do it. It would be impossible without a room, a full-time room.
And so now that, the film has come out and opportunities, I think, there's many more opportunities for you. And what are you looking forward to doing now? I know you have things going on, some of which I don't know what you want to talk about, but what's the dream now?
Just retire early. Divorce my husband, like marry an 18-year-old, get a coke addiction. I don't know. I mean, honestly, it's all been so incredibly mad and amazing. I've been lucky because I'm doing a stage show. I've written the book for the stage show of Cinderella, basically the script, I guess. Andrew Lloyd Webber's, composed the music, and David Zippel, who is an amazing lyricist, and he did stuff like he did Hercules, Disney's Hercules and Mulan and all those amazing films. So we're doing that. So we're about to, the moment things open up again, we'll be able to start rehearsals. And that's hopefully going to be in the West End in spring, summer.
Wow.
And again, that's another amazing thing because it's just, it's just learning from the best. I'm just when it comes to this stuff, I'm so, such a novice. And so it's just been really thrilling to do something. And also it's Cinderella and it's a proper romantic comedy, and it's lavish, and it's going to be live, and there's a full orchestra. It's just like, now more than ever, I've never, ever, ever wanted to see someone wearing the biggest costume in the world singing with a live orchestra. Like, I'm just desperate for a start. But as for everything else, I think I hope I'll just do the usual thing, which is I'm just about to finish a script, and once it's finished, I'll see if anyone likes it, and that will, and hopefully someone will. And if not, then I'll start the next thing. But in general, I think I'm unlikely to do. I'm unlikely to kind of do anything. I'm unlikely to make the sort of the relationship decisions before I have the thing that is, I don't know, I'm so bad at explaining it, but it's so important to see the actual response to the thing itself rather than,
right.
So I think even though there are so many people that I love, that I would love to work with, that I just, I think though that not everyone is going to love everything. And like, it's a huge mistake, I think, to be, to go with the most exciting, sexy thing if it's just not right. I was so lucky. I've been so lucky to work with just so many amazing people that and who have been so like right and so good and so trustworthy that I just think it's a kind of, I hope it's the right thing, because my head is so easily turned. I'm so venal and crazy. So it's sort of better. It's better for me to stay away and just do the writing.
Yeah.
Leave everything last minute.
I think that makes a ton of sense. I think few people can have the willpower to resist the kinds of,
well, let's see.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. We'll catch back up.
Titanic 4.
Yeah.
And finally find it. Right. I don't know. It's sort of funny because we're speaking now just after, the Golden Globe nominations were announced, and it still feels so much like a fever dream.
Right.
That I kind of, I still don't know. I still don't know what's going on really. So it's so nice to talk about Spacebound because I love it. I loved it. And I love doing the read through so much.
It's
wonderful. And I thank you for doing it. Thank you for getting in touch, because it was just such a joy, actually. It was such a joy.
Oh, I'm so glad. I know you know, when I've done things of my own on the show, what's so great is it's just done. There's not all that work, even though you have those pangs of, oh, I'd like to change that. You don't have to. It's just that was it. You just have the joy and
well, it's long enough away, I think, that you get a bit of detachment too. So it's not, it is, you can be a bit proud of it actually in a way that probably you're not when you just hand something in. Like I felt very, you know, I don't know. I just felt it was just really lovely. It's lovely. So thank you.
Well, thank you for helping put that cast together. It was
the best. They loved the podcast, so it was very easy.
Oh, it was great. Well, it was so great to talk to you. And congratulations again. We'll be rooting for you. Everyone should see the movie when they can. And thanks so much for letting us do it.
Of course. Thank you for doing it. Can't wait to hear it.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them?
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play?
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies?
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
What an absolute pleasure that was talking to Emerald. Maybe it got you itching to write a flatshare comedy. Dead Pilot Society is produced by me and my co-host Ben Blacker and our associate producer Noah Findling. I also want to mention that our great new logo was designed by Stefan Lawrence. You can find him on social media at Stefan Patrick. That's at StefanPatrick. Maybe you have some graphic design needs. He's great. Hey, if you like the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Really helps us find new listeners. Maybe tell a friend about us. You can find us on social media. We're on Twitter at Dead Pilots Pod and on Instagram at Dead Pilots Society. Maybe hop on there and tell us what you think of this new split format. Next month, we are going to bring you another amazing British writer, Tessa Coates, with a fantastic pilot called Primates, which has a crazy story. It is one of the Quibi casualties. Great cast, Maria Bamford, many other people, just a really amazing cast. So until then, I'm Andrew Reich. Thanks so much for listening.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.